reasons why people joined the crusade. The crusades really get very little coverage, usually in high schools and colleges. It's a very, very relatively brief incident. You almost have to major in medieval history, which was one of my minors, to get a real detailed account of it. So when you talk about why people went on a crusade, the standard run of the mill reason is for religious zeal. You know, the Christians / Catholics in Europe were inspired by Pope Urban to go on this first crusade, and I think I'm going to just leave it here at the first crusade, because each of the various crusades has different motivation. So let's just deal with the first crusade. And we have these preachers going around France. Most of the first crusade is, for the most part, from the Franks, I should say, recruiting people. And, you know, hey, let's go and rescue the Holy Land from the Muslims. So religious zeal obviously is going to play a part. Another reason that's usually given is that, well, you know, if you go on a crusade and you're killed fighting in the Holy Land, you'll go straight to heaven. Which, of course, leads us to the point of view of the Muslim side, that if you're killed fighting these people, although they're not infidels, remember, in the Muslim tradition, Christians and Jews are perverted brothers of the book, so they're not non-believers. But still, you're fighting for Islam, and if you get killed, you go straight to heaven. So there must have been a real log jam at the pearly gates with people pointing at each other when battles were over. So that's another standard one. Then we get to the other stuff. We've got to get people to go. We want nobles, but we need some other people. Now, serfs could go if they signed up to go on a crusade. They had to be allowed to leave their land. So here's an opportunity for people who, you know, are oppressed or not being well treated to leave. Now, that's not going to provide you with the highest quality soldier from a fighting standpoint, nor a very well-equipped individual. But there are lots of serfs that went. If you look at the People's Crusade during the People's section of the First Crusade, thousands upon thousands of just regular people went. Another thing is, if you're a citizen and you went on a crusade, you were exempt from taxes. Well, while you're on the crusade, and not until you came back. If you didn't come back, I would assume you weren't going to pay any taxes. You'd have a lot of people sign up today just for that purpose. We save money. If you owed money, your debts were held while you were in the Holy Land. So you didn't have to pay on your debt, and nothing could be taken away from you while you were on a crusade. Again, that may or may not provide you with the highest quality of soldier. If you're a prisoner, you're in prison somewhere, in jail, if you say that you want to sign up to go on the crusade, well, they set you free. And, of course, probably not planning on coming back at that point, which of course gives us a little better form of fighter. If you are under a death sentence, if you go on a crusade, if you sign up to go on the crusade, that death sentence will be commuted to life service in the Holy Land. Well, one would assume that every murderer getting ready to be executed is going to sign up to go on a crusade. Now, that gives you an excellent fighter. But then again, it may be difficult to control that individual once the fighting does start. A lot of the nobles went for very simple reasons: money and land, which actually can be the same thing. We're not talking about a lot of cash money at this time. You'd be talking about looting at the time. But land, definitely. There has the land holdings in Europe, by the time you get to the First Crusade, have become smaller and smaller because there hasn't been any great war, any serious disease had gone through the country. Therefore, the fiefs were shrinking in size. Well, here's a chance to really add on, because the way it was set up, that if you defeated a Muslim and they refused to convert to Christianity, you could then take all their stuff. So the crusaders, the fighters, really aren't interested in conversion. They're interested in conquering. And so that new land, and if you look at what happens in the Holy Land at the end of the First Crusade, I mean, it's divided up and turned into a little Europe with the various kingdoms, and then those kingdoms subdivided into fiefdoms and all that good stuff. So that's what's going to get the noblemen to go in. One of the reasons why you don't find many kings on the First Crusade, they pretty good shape. Then, of course, there are the adventurers. There are people who were looking for the biblical land of milk and honey. I mean, the knowledge of the Holy Land, actual knowledge of climate and what it was like to the European during the First Crusade is horrible. They're going on various accounts from the Old Testament, land of milk and honey. They didn't realize it was going to be hot and it was going to be dry, and there wasn't a lot of milk flowing and honey was hard to get. But there are many people, and you have some noble women who, when they go on the crusade, think it's going to be really fun. Of course, then they get there, it's hot and ucky, you know, and they want to go home. You also have, one of the misconceptions you have is that, you know, the crusading men joined up and left. There are women and children that followed their husbands, because how are they supposed to live on their property? If they're a serf, I would assume the serf women and children could continue working at that thing, but you'd want to take your wife and children if you started a new land. So there, it isn't just all men. There were lots of men, which of course means most of the armies were followed by large numbers of prostitutes, since some people would be interested in their services for quite some time. Now, different crusades, I mean, obviously priests are going to get involved in this as well, and most of them are, of course, motivated by religious zeal. And some of them, such as the papal legate on the First Crusade, his job was not just to kind of keep track of the leadership of the crusade, but he was also trying to heal the rift that occurred between the Orthodox Church in the East and the Roman Catholic Church in the West. So Admar had a lot that he was trying to accomplish, and of course his death is a disaster to the First Crusade, because now there really is no strong leader, religious leader, to keep the noblemen under control. So as you can see, there are lots of different reasons that people went on the crusade. If you study the Muslim histories of the Crusades, and there are actually more Muslim eyewitness accounts of the Crusades that survive to us than from the European side. The only problem is most of those historians are not interested in what we like, the blow-by-blow account of what took place and the great deeds and the great people. Most of their writing is about the reason why the crusade took place, and most of them would say that there's a crusade for one real simple reason, and that is the land and the wealth. And you even have some divisions between the different groups of Muslims. You have the Seljuk Turks, who claim that the Muslims in Egypt, the Fatimids, actually encouraged the Crusaders to come to fight the Saracens. In other words, the Seljuk Turks, who were battling the Fatimids for control of that particular region. So there's a lot of finger-pointing and all kinds of other stuff. So those are some of the reasons why people went on the Crusades. You know, it isn't just, you know, you always have to be careful when you're reading history texts, particularly in high school, and you've really got to read some deeper content work to find out what really took place. Because I have seen textbooks at the high school level where there's two paragraphs on the Crusades and one paragraph on the Hundred Years' War, and then they go on. So you're left with what you see in a film. And I can highly recommend two books. For the casual crusading person, I would highly recommend Robert Payne's book, The Dream and the Tomb, A History of the Crusades. That has been out for a few years. It should still be pretty readily available, probably even used and cheap. But it's one book which has a good overall account of there are actually eight of them named, but you know, once you finish the Third Crusade with Richard the Lionhearted, they're just not quite the same big event any longer. But it gives you a good concise background as to what's going on. I say concise, the book's still probably 400 pages long. If you are really looking to get into the deep material and you have some money, what you want then is Stephen Runciman's books, three-volume set, The History of the Crusades. First volume is The First Crusade, and the other two will then deal with the second, the third, and the fourth. Dr. Runciman is the present living, he's very, very, very old, world-renowned historian on the Crusades and the Hundred Years' War. The problem is, I mean, the paperback book that I have, which is from about 25 years ago, was 1695. And I've seen these done in folio editions, and they're just really expensive. So try and find a used copy of it if you can, or check it out from the library. But Runciman's books are the core of teaching and learning about the Crusades. So come by my site, SumaHistorica.com, and see what else is there. Thank you very much.